Is it true that Canada has always been a terre d'asile, has a tradition of accepting refugees?
I would say that the idea of Canada being a terre d'asile or a humanitarian nation that's always been open to accepting refugees is definitely something that Canadians like to believe and that the Canadian government, successive Canadian governments, have liked to promote. But the reality, when you look at Canada's history, is that, in fact, we have been incredibly selective about which groups of refugees we will assist and under what terms and conditions. And I think that what we can't forget is we can't divorce Canada's larger immigration history with its approach to refugees. The two are very much intertwined. And so when you look at Canadian immigration history in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, what you see is an immigration policy that privileged migrants from the British, Isles, from Northern Europe, and yet was very closed to migrants from Asia, China, Japan, and India. And that actually informs Canada's refugee policy as well. So there's always been a desire to select refugees that will fit into the larger national framework or national landscape as it was imagined at the time. And certainly Canada's perception of what the national framework should look like has evolved dramatically, particularly in the post-war period after the Second World War. But at the same time, the idea of selecting the best immigrants, those immigrants who can contribute to the labor market or who have families in Canada who can support their settlement and admission, has very much informed Canada's refugee policies. Canada doesn't really start to take refugees in significant numbers until after the Second World War, and those who are assisted after the Second World War are largely from Europe, from camps across Europe, the displaced person camps and refugee camps. And it's only in the late 1970s that Canada begins to accept refugees from other parts of the world in a consistent way. And so, yes, Canada does have a humanitarian tradition. It's one that we can be proud of to a certain extent because we certainly have assisted refugees fleeing all kinds of difficult circumstances. But to suggest that Canada's history has consistently been a humanitarian one would be to ignore the large numbers of people who were excluded both from Canada's immigration policies, but also from the way that the refugee, who was a refugee, was imagined and how those people were assisted. So it's I think we need to temper any kind of celebratory narrative around Canada as a humanitarian nation and actually think about how can we be more humanitarian, where have we failed in the past, and how can we improve in the future. And there's one anecdote that I think is really telling, and that is one of the incidents that gets cited as evidence of Canada not being a humanitarian nation is the voyage of the St. Louis, which is a boat carrying Jewish refugees from Europe that was turned away from Cuba, from the United States, and then from Canada, and was forced to return to Europe. Many of the Jewish refugees on that boat perished in the Holocaust, and that the voyage of the St. Louis is held up as evidence of Canada failing to provide humanitarian assistance, necessary protection to refugees who are Jewish, because at the time anti-Semitism was quite rife in Canada. And one of the stories that I think is so revealing in terms of how things have changed since the Second World War was that when the Indo-Chinese refugee movement occurred in the late 1970s, Canadian officials working in the Department of Manpower and Immigration were given, None Is Too Many, a book about the voyage of St. Louis and anti-Semitism in Canada, to read, and were told that this should not happen under their watch. And so the approach to the Indo-Chinese refugees was very, very different from that of how officials responded to the voyage of the St. Louis. So within, you know, it's a 40-year period, but there was a great deal of change. And I think Canada's desire to be a humanitarian nation and its self-promotion as such is really a post-war phenomena, and one that in many ways disguises the failures of earlier decades. disguises the exclusionary immigration policies and practices of the early 20th century and late 19th century. And so it's a narrative, as I say, that we need to be cautious about, that we can certainly accept to a certain extent, but that we can interrogate and ask, well, how humanitarian has Canada really been, and what more can be done if we truly believe that we are a humanitarian nation and we have a responsibility to protect the world's refugees.
In Canadian history, there were a few important waves of refugee. Please talk a little bit about that.
There were some very important waves. And one of the interesting things is to think about, what do we mean by important? Is important numerical? Is it important? Is a group important because of their geographic origin or their cultural origin? So in the early 20th century, for example, because of the kinds of oppression that was happening in the Russian Empire, Canada did accept Duke of War refugees, for instance, who settled in the Canadian West. And that became a very important group in terms of the larger Canadian landscape, because they're ultra-pacifist, and there became tensions in the subsequent decades about where they fit into the Canadian mosaic, if you want to call it that. And so certain groups have had a profound impact, not because they were numerically large, but because they brought certain cultural and political ideas that the Canadian nation then needed to reconcile and think about, where does this fit into the broader national framework. So the Duke of Boers, for example, are not a large group, but they did come in the early 20th century, and I would argue have had a very important impact in terms of shaping Canadian immigration policy more broadly. And in terms of significant numbers, really we can start looking at the post-Second World War period as a time when Canada began to accept larger numbers of refugees. There was certainly significant displacement globally after the First World War and in the interwar period, but it wasn't a time when countries were taking in large numbers of refugees and didn't feel a sense of obligation towards assisting refugees in the way that happens after the Second World War. The Second World War and the Holocaust in particular really shock people into wanting to respond and address humanitarian needs in innovative and unprecedented ways. So there's a great debate amongst historians about how much changed between the First World War and the Second World War. And I would say that the Second World War really does mark a shift in how the world, including Canada, responded to refugees. So you have large numbers of displaced persons and refugees coming to Canada. Almost a quarter of a million come from Europe after the Second World War. And then because of the Cold War and the politics between liberal democracies and communist countries, there's a growing desire amongst liberal democracies to show that they are indeed humanitarian and committed to human rights and universal human rights. And so there's a resettlement and an effort to help refugees who are leaving Soviet oppression in particular. So in Canada, this means that the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, when thousands of people leave Hungary and many settle in Austria in refugee camps, Canada takes in 37,000 refugees in that particular crisis. And then 12 years later, with the Soviet oppression of the Prague Spring, 11,000 Czech refugees are resettled to Canada. And so these are major movements that have informed the way that the Canadian government and Canadians think about the country as a humanitarian nation. I would say that the Hungarian refugees and the Czech refugees, as well as the thousands of displaced people who came to Canada after the Second World War, are cited as evidence of Canada as a humanitarian nation. If I can talk a little bit about the evolution in terms of policy, what is really interesting about looking at Canadian policy after the Second World War is that much of the approach to refugees is completely ad hoc. It's discretionary. There is no formal refugee definition in Canadian law. Internationally, the Refugee Convention, the UN Convention relating to the status of refugees is developed in 1951. Canada doesn't sign until 1969, and it's only with the 1976 Immigration Act that Canada defines a refugee for the first time in Canadian law. So up until 1976, what you have are very discretionary approaches to who will be assisted as a refugee and what kinds of assistance will be provided. So in the case of displaced persons from Europe, often people who had family in Canada already were given preference because the idea was that their families would be able to help them establish themselves in the country. There was always a concern that if you were accepting refugees, they might not fit well into the labor market, they might not fit in well socially or culturally, but if you had a family member who could assist you, then that would improve your likelihood of success. And so as much as Canada was helping people who were in difficult situations, the Canadian government was also looking at were they employable, did they have skills, did they have family members, and this informed the kinds of people who were selected and resettled until the 1970s, when you start to have a very different political and legal environment in which the UN Convention definition of a refugee takes precedence. And that definition is all about an individual who has a fear of persecution, who is outside their country of origin and seeks protection from a country like Canada. In that case, the Canadian government can't simply turn away a refugee. They must consider their claims to refugee status and whether or not the individual does indeed have a fear of persecution. So, sorry, I feel like I've rambled a bit, but that's a very large picture of both the significant refugee movements and the way that the political landscape changes in the 1970s. And I will just conclude by saying that, as I mentioned earlier, how we measure important or significant does depend on whether we want to think about numerical terms or whether we want to think about the cultural origins or geographic origins of a group of people. And that's why I would say that in addition to the European refugees that I've mentioned previously, the other major group that is regularly cited as evidence of Canada's great humanitarianism is the resettlement of refugees from Indochina after 1975. So refugees from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam who are fleeing both the end of the Vietnam War and the political repercussions that occurred in Southeast Asia after the war. Canadians privately sponsored thousands of Indochinese refugees, and the government also provided assistance to thousands of refugees. And that movement in particular has been celebrated because it really is the largest movement of refugees Canada has ever received. And it's significant because they were refugees coming from Asia. And so a stark contrast to the earlier interest and priority placed on refugees in Europe.
Talking about Asian refugee, is it true that most of these boat people from Vietnam, they are Chinese origin?
Yeah, I don't have the exact statistics, but a number of the refugees who did come from Vietnam were ethnic Chinese because of their they were particularly targeted after the Vietnam War because they were seen as affluent and not committed to the new vision of the Vietnamese communist state, and so they faced considerable persecution. So a number of the refugees who did leave Vietnam in particular were ethnic Chinese migrants. And so, yeah, it's a really, I can get you the stats. I don't have them with me right now, but a large number of the Vietnamese refugees were in fact ethnic Chinese who were fairly affluent in Vietnamese society and under the new communist government were no longer welcome in Vietnam.
I didn't know before yesterday there are some Indo-Chinese in Canada, because in 70s, I think, Chinese government accepted some Indo-Chinese refugee.
Yeah, yeah.
And then most of them went to Hong Kong. So Canadian government accepted some of them?
Some did come from Hong Kong. And actually what's really interesting about the Indo-Chinese refugee story is that in Canada we hear about it as a Canadian story because almost 70,000 refugees came to Canada, but it was actually a global story. I mean, people were going to Australia, New Zealand. A number of people ended up in camps in Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Thailand, and there was a 10-year evolution in terms of the international community's response about how people were going to be assisted. And many of the refugees did go to China thinking that they would be prosperous there, that they would be welcomed back. And many of them were discouraged by the conditions that they found in China and then moved to Hong Kong. And there's a whole complicated history around how the Hong Kong government responded to refugees. But essentially, the Hong Kong government felt that it didn't want to have refugees because the colony was quite quite crowded and there was no room, and they were concerned about the impact that large numbers of refugees would have on the economy. And the camps in Hong Kong are there until quite late, and there begins to be a concern that as Hong Kong is about to be handed over to the People's Republic of China, one of the issues that comes up is the need to clear out the camps. And so there's all kinds of pressure on the international community to help alleviate the situation by taking people from camps in Hong Kong. And Canada certainly is one of the countries that had a very good working relationship with the Hong Kong government. And a number of the refugees who came to Canada were in fact in Hong Kong first, and then came to Canada. Similarly, a number of the refugees who made their ways to Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, they were in camps for a number of months or even years, and then were resettled to countries like Canada and the United States. So it wasn't a direct flight from Vietnam or Cambodia or Laos. There was often quite a long waiting period in these camps as people tried to figure out who they wanted to resettle, what kinds of family connections, because again, that the Canadian government put tremendous value on reuniting families and ensuring that there was some kind of support network for people who were coming to Canada, because the idea was that the Indo-Chinese refugees were not going to be familiar with Canadian society. There was all kinds of concern about the weather, especially, and not wanting people to arrive in the middle of a Montreal winter. So even as we're talking about how the government assisted refugees, there's always, as there had been in the early part of the post-war period, this concern about how will people settle in. And certainly the Indo-Chinese refugee movement is considered a success because the government invested so much time and energy in providing support at all levels. So the federal government, provincial governments, municipal governments, and then you had private sponsors who were taking on the responsibility of helping refugees for their first year in Canada. And that kind of intense dedication of resources is something that hasn't been repeated since the Indo-Chinese refugee movement. So it's really held up as an extraordinary example of Canadian humanitarianism. So not the norm. We like to think of it as the norm, but it's actually an extraordinary example.
Oh, I didn't know that, because people talk more about Vietnamese boat people. But talking about Asian refugee, you correct me if I'm not right. It seems to me that the key word is communism.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I think is so interesting is that at the same time that the Cold War was taking place in Europe, the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet Union, and there was China went communist in 1949. All kinds of shifting political regimes in Asia, and the startling contrast between how Western countries like Canada were willing to respond to refugees from communism in Europe and yet almost completely ignore refugees from communism in Asia. Because you're absolutely right that one of the key factors in shaping refugee movements in Asia was the presence or the emergence of communist governments. The other significant factor were the decolonization movements, so the kinds of political turmoil that resulted from countries throwing off the shackles of empire. So India, for instance, in 1947, the partition of the Indian subcontinent creates thousands and thousands of refugees, and very few are assisted internationally. There is, and we can talk more about the politics of assistance, because moving to another country is not necessarily the best way of helping a refugee. You know, many people believe that the best way to help a refugee is to help them get home again. But what is striking is that what was considered a solution for European refugees in terms of resettling them to a country like Canada for protection was not the kind of solution that was envisioned for the refugees in Asia. And I have looked extensively at the history of refugees from the People's Republic of China, which is a long-standing history now of over five decades, because people began to leave in the late 1940s with the civil war and the kinds of violence and turmoil that that resulted from the long civil war. Once communist regime was established in Beijing, a number of people, particularly entrepreneurs and businessmen from Shanghai, moved to Hong Kong or followed the Kuomintang to Taiwan with the idea of a temporary refuge. There was an expectation that the situation in China would change again, that they would be able to return home. And so there was never an idea that the move was going to be permanent, that they had departed China forever, because the ties to the homeland were indeed very strong. And what happened was, as the communist regime became more established and introduced programs like the Great Leap Forward and then later the Cultural Revolution, which caused so much turmoil, economic distress, and so many stories of individual persecution, is that at that point, people decided they weren't going to return to the People's Republic of China. And so they needed to make decisions about where they would indeed stay. So many of them do stay in Hong Kong, and many scholars attribute the rise of Hong Kong's post-war economy to the fact that there were so many affluent and talented refugees in the colony. So a number of people stay in Hong Kong, but another number of people also want to move abroad. And that's very complicated to do. Canada doesn't introduce a universal point system really until it begins to do so in 1962, but it's not until 1967 that the barriers, the racial barriers to immigration are eliminated. So you have about a 20-year period where there are people in Hong Kong who would like to leave, but actually aren't eligible to do so under Canadian immigration laws. And the first time that Canada does accept a group of refugees from Asia is in 1962, and it's a group of 100 families from Hong Kong who were fleeing famine conditions in southwestern China. And it was an entirely political decision made by Prime Minister Diefenbaker, who was on the campaign trail and was trying to attract Chinese-Canadian voters. And so in a moment of sort of inspiration, he announces this resettlement program, much to the surprise and in many ways shock of officials in the Department of Citizenship and Immigration, who were completely unprepared and very reluctant to encourage Chinese migration by actually resettling families from Hong Kong. But that's what happened in 62, and it was an entirely unprecedented offer. And those families came to Canada, and from what I know, all settled in and did very well. But that was that example shows, even though there were millions of people at this point who had left China, Canada took in 100 families. So it's a very small number in terms of assistance compared to the large numbers of people who were actually moving across Asia. And so the story of China is probably one of the largest examples in terms of numerical numbers of refugees, but you have similar refugees, Chinese ethnic refugees leaving Malaysia as Malaysia decolonizes, Indonesia. There's all kinds of turbulence, and people are making decisions about, do they want to seek temporary refuge in a neighboring country? Do they want to venture further afield? Even countries like South Africa, which have a very small Chinese population, in the 1960s, the Chinese community was confronting the reality of living under apartheid, where they were considered non-white, and so they weren't treated as badly as Black South Africans, but they certainly did not have all the privileges of the white majority. And a number of South Africans, Chinese South Africans, decide in the 1960s that they're going to leave South Africa simply because they don't know what the future holds for them under apartheid. And many of them do come to Canada. There's actually a significant percentage of the Chinese community in Canada that has South African connections. So it's when we think about the idea of Chinese refugees, it's not just refugees from the People's Republic of China, but they actually, because of the way that the Chinese diaspora worked and the networks and connections that existed across international borders, people are moving in all kinds of ways. And Canada actually does very little when you think about the large numbers of people who are moving to assist those people in need.
Yeah, it's really a beginning, 1962. And this Asian people or Asian refugee, Chinese refugee, how Canadian public accept them?
Yeah, it's a really complicated, it's a great question. It's a really complicated answer. I'm not sure that China is the number one source country for refugees. It certainly is for immigration. China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan are up there in terms of the top countries. The refugee numbers are really scattered. But there are two ways that people can come to Canada as refugees. One is where they're resettled by the government. So the government recently announced a commitment to assist refugees from Syria. So they're, you know, presumably officials are in refugee camps selecting Syrian refugees to be resettled to Canada. And the other way that people can be accepted in the country as refugees is if they present themselves at a Canadian port of entry and say, I am a refugee, I have a fear of persecution, and I would like to be protected. And so under Canadian law, the Immigration and Refugee Board is responsible for hearing these refugee claims and making a determination about whether or not someone does indeed have a claim to refugee status. And I would say there's a real misconception amongst the Canadian public and even amongst some government officials about those two ways that Canada accepts refugees. And I think some people think you can only, you know, you should only be helping people that the government decides is a refugee beforehand and not people who present themselves at the Canadian border. And probably the best example of that kind of reaction was in 1999 when you had boats of migrants arriving on the BC coast from Fujian province. And the backlash was really strong because people were saying, these aren't refugees, these are just people who are benefiting from human smuggling operations, or they're being exploited by human smuggling operations, but they're not refugees and we shouldn't protect them. And there's a really interesting gulf between how people respond to the idea of refugees when they have a decision or when they have the opportunity to say, yes, this person is a refugee and we're going to help them, versus the kind of media coverage and the response that boat arrivals have in terms of Canada's sovereignty being threatened, the immigration system being under threat. And the reality is that people make refugee claims every day in Canadian airports, and we just don't see it in the same way that we see the boats. So I would say that there remains a great deal of concern and anxiety amongst Canadians about who refugees are, about how they come to make refugee claims in Canada, and about the merits of their claims. And I think many people are much more comfortable when the government or private sponsors determine that they're going to go and help a particular group of refugees. But one of the things that's happened in the past 60 years is that the international refugee regime and Canada's own approach to refugees has evolved so that we have an obligation to hear people's claims when they present themselves and say, I have a fear of persecution and I would like to be protected. And I think that's where people remain more nervous and more anxious about the implications of, does that mean we're going to get, you know, too many applications from China, too many applications from Africa? What are the repercussions of that? To go back to your question about the reception of refugees, I think that it's a very, I think on the one hand, it is a very generous reception, but I think that the anxiety and the concern about who refugees are and how they might affect Canadian society seems to be pervasive in much of the contemporary discussion around refugees. I think people have very romantic notions or confused notions about who refugees are, what their histories are like, and why they are in Canada. And that's something that we need to really shed a lot more light on.
Thank you very much, Professor Madogoro.